Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. The Humanist Schism.
Part 2.
Evolutionary humanism has a different solution to the problem of conflicting human experiences. Rooting itself in the firm ground of Darwinian evolutionary theory, it says that conflict is something that to applaud rather than lament. Conflict is the raw material of natural selection which pushes evolution forward. Some humans are simply superior to others, and when human experiences collide, the fittest humans should steamroll everyone else. The same logic that drives humankind to exterminate wild wolves and to ruthlessly exploit domesticated sheep also mandates the oppression of inferior humans by their superiors. It's a good thing that Europeans conquer Africans and that shrewd businessmen drive the dim-witted to bankruptcy. If we follow this evolutionary logic, humankind will gradually become stronger and fitter, eventually giving rise to superhumans. Evolution did not stop with Homo sapiens. There is still a long way to go. However, if in the name of human rights or human equality we emasculate the fittest humans, it will prevent the rise of the Superman and may even cause the degeneration and extinction of Homo sapiens. Who exactly are these superhumans who herald the coming of the Superman? They might be entire races, particular tribes, or exceptional individual geniuses. In any case, what makes them superior is that they have better abilities manifested in the creation of new knowledge, more advanced technology, more prosperous societies, or more beautiful art. The experience of an Einstein or a Beethoven is far more valuable than that of a drunken good-for-nothing, and it is ludicrous to treat them as if they have equal merit. Similarly, if a particular nation has consistently spearheaded human progress, we should rightly consider it superior to other nations that contributed little or nothing to the evolution of humankind. Consequently, in contrast to liberal artists like Odo Dix, evolutionary humanism thinks that the human experience of war is valuable and even essential. The movie The Third Man takes place in Vienna immediately after the end of the Second World War. Reflecting on the recent conflict, the character Harry Lime says, "After all, it's not that awful. In Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love, they had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock." Lime gets almost all his facts wrong. Switzerland was probably the most bloodthirsty corner of early modern Europe. Its main exports was mercenary soldiers, and the cuckoo clock was actually invented by the Germans. But the facts are of lesser importance than Lime's idea, namely that the experience of war pushes humankind to new achievements. War allows natural selection, free rein at last. It exterminates the weak and rewards the fierce and the ambitious. War exposes the truth about life and awakens the will for power, for glory, and for conquest. Nietzsche summed it up by saying that war is the school of life and that what does not kill me makes me stronger. Similar ideas were expressed by Lieutenant Harry Jones of the British Army. 3 days before his death, on the Western Front in the First World War, the 21-year-old Jones sent a letter to his brother describing the experience of war in glowing terms. "Have you ever reflected on the fact that despite the horrors of war, it is at least a big thing? I mean to say that in it, one is brought face to face with realities, the follies, selfishness, luxury and general pettiness of the vile commercial sort of existence led by 9/10 of the people of the world in peacetime are replaced in war by a savagery that is at least more honest and outspoken. Look at it this way. In peacetime, one just lives one's own little life, engaged in trivialities, worrying about one's own comfort, about money matters, and all that sort of thing. Just living for one's own self. What a sordid life it is. In war, on the other hand, even if you do get killed, you only anticipate the inevitable by a few years in any case, and you have the satisfaction of knowing that you have pegged out in the attempt to help your country. You have, in fact, realized an ideal which, as far as I can see, you very rarely do in ordinary life. The reason is that ordinary life runs on a commercial and selfish basis. If you want to get on, as the saying is, you can't keep your hands clean. Personally, I often rejoice that the war has come my way. It has made me realize what a petty thing life is. I think that the war has given to everyone a chance to get out of himself, as I might say. Certainly, speaking for myself, I can say that I have never in all my life experienced such a wild exhilaration as on the commencement of a big stunt, like the last April one, for example. The excitement for the last half hour or so, because it is like nothing on Earth. In his bestseller, Black Hawk Down, the journalist Mark Bowden relates in similar terms the combat experience of Sean Nelson, an American soldier in Mogadishu in 1993. It was hard to describe how he felt. It was like an epiphany. Close to death, he had never felt so completely alive. There had been split seconds in his life when he'd felt death brush past, like when another fast-moving car veered from around a sharp curve and just missed hitting him head-on. On this day, he had lived with that feeling, with death breathing right in his face, for moment after moment after moment, for 3 hours or more. Combat was a state of complete mental and physical awareness. In those hours on the street, he had not been Sean Nelson. He had no connection to the larger world, no bills to pay, no emotional ties, nothing. He had just been a human being, staying alive from one nanosecond to the next, drawing one breath after another, fully aware that each one might be his last. He felt he would never be the same. Adolf Hitler, too, was changed and enlightened by his war experiences. In Mein Kampf, he tells how shortly after his unit reached the front line, the soldiers' initial enthusiasm turned into fear, against which each soldier had to wage a relentless inner war, straining every nerve to avoid being overwhelmed by it. Hitler says that he won this inner war by the winter of 1915-16. At last, he writes, my will was undisputed master. I was now calm and determined, and this was enduring. Now fate could bring on the ultimate test without my nerves shattering or my reason failing. The experience of war revealed to Hitler the truth about the world. It is a jungle run by the remorseless laws of natural selection. Those who refuse to recognize this truth cannot survive. If you wish to succeed, you must not only understand the laws of the jungle, but embrace them joyfully. It should be stressed that just like the anti-war liberal artists, Hitler too sanctified the experience of ordinary soldiers. Indeed, Hitler's political career is one of the best examples we have for the immense authority according to the personal experience of common people in 20th century politics. Hitler was not a senior officer. In 4 years of war, he rose no higher than the rank of corporal. He had no formal education, no professional skills, and no political background. He was not a successful businessman or a union activist. He did not have friends or relatives in high places, or any money to speak of. At first, he didn't even have German citizenship. He was a penniless immigrant. When Hitler appealed to the German voters and asked for their trust, he could muster only one argument in his favor. His experiences in the trenches had taught him what you can never learn at university, at general headquarters, or at a government ministry. People followed him and voted for him because they identified with him, and because they too believed that the world is a jungle, and that what doesn't kill us only makes us stronger. Whereas liberalism merged with the mild diversions of nationalism to protect the unique experiences of each human community, evolutionary humanists such as Hitler identified particular nations as the engines of a human progress, and concluded that these nations ought to bludgeon or even exterminate anyone standing in their way. It should be remembered, though, that Hitler and the Nazis represent only one extreme version of evolutionary humanism. Just as Stalin's gulags do not automatically nullify every socialist idea and argument, so too the horrors of Nazism should not blind us to whatever insights evolutionary humanism might offer. Nazism was born from the pairing of evolutionary humanism with particular racial theories and ultra-nationalist emotions. Not all evolutionary humanists are racists. And not every belief in humankind's potential for further evolution necessarily calls for setting up police states and concentration camps. Auschwitz should serve as a blood-red warning sign rather than as a black curtain that hides entire sections of the human horizon. Evolutionary humanism played an important part in the shaping of modern culture, and it is likely to play an even greater role in the shaping of the 21st century. That's it for today. I create a lot of content, I run a debating podcast, I write stories, I film videos with a drone, and I run many other projects too. If you'd like to stay informed of things I do, sign up to my private newsletter, it's free. Head to bit.ly/newslettersebastian, all attached and in lowercase. Thank you for listening.